America's national motto is, "In God We Trust." But sometimes you really wouldn't think it was that as you survey the national landscape. Right now, we're going to talk about the whole issue of one nation under God. Are we, and does it matter? And why does it matter? With John Eidsmo, who is a law professor. He's also a best-selling author. Some of his books include Christianity and the Constitution. I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Focal Point. And John Eidsmo, we welcome you back to the program. Thanks so much for being with us.
And thank you, Jerry. You do such a great job of getting the word out, and you are a scholar in your own right.
Well,
I appreciate you very much.
Well, I appreciate you, too. Okay, so before we bore the audience with this mutual appreciation party, so tell me, are we one nation under God, and does it matter? And if so, why? You go ahead and wax eloquent.
We're founded as one nation under God, and yes, it matters a great deal. For one thing, God is the source of all governmental authority. Scriptures make that very clear. Our Declaration of Independence makes it clear when it says that we are entitled to our independence by the laws of nature and of nature's God. So, yes, from a biblical standpoint and from an ideological standpoint, it makes sense. But also, it's important to understand this concept because our rights come from God. You think about it, a question. We look at the Declaration of Independence once again when it says that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. If rights come from government, then they're not really rights at all, and they're not unalienable. If government gives rights, government can take them away, so they're negotiable privileges. And the biggest barrier that we have toward a centralized, tyrannical government is the concept that we have rights that the government may not tread upon. And the only firm basis for believing in those rights is to say that they come from a higher source than man, a higher source than government. And what source can that be but God? I remember being at a law school conference one time where there was a discussion of leading legal scholars across the country on the nature of human rights. And it was just pathetic to hear them try to articulate sources of rights like mutual convenience. Well, it may be mutual convenient in the long run for everybody to have rights, but in the short run, it might benefit me to violate people's rights. Government, custom, nature, and of course, Thomas Hobbes said that our rights come from nature, you know, the idea of the law of nature and natural rights, that every animal, when he's cornered, defends himself, therefore self-defense is a law of nature, a natural right. But a lot of things happen in nature. This is the fallen world. A lot of things happen in nature that we certainly wouldn't want to be a basis for the way we think today. The point is, without the concept of God-given human rights, there is no basis for freedom. And without that, then our whole idea of having a nation falls. One nation under God, yes, we are. That is what we are founded as, and that's essential to continuing as the free nation that we have been.
And yet we hear about all these statistics where some people are saying this all with glee, that Christianity is no longer the dominant religion, or soon it will be that way if the present trends continue. And you sort of feel like this is definitely feeling like a post-Christian society.
It seems that we are moving in that direction here in America today, but remember the promise that Jesus gave when he said to Peter, "Thou art Peter, upon this rock," referring to himself, "I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." That is the promise that the church will prevail and will ultimately triumph. And yes, we do see an eclipse of Christianity temporarily, but we see that in North America, and we see it in Western Europe. Throughout most of the rest of the world, we see Christianity expanding today. We see Christianity growing by leaps and bounds in Africa, and it's conservative, Bible-believing, evangelical Christianity. It may not be long before Africa starts sending Christian missionaries to the United States. We see Christianity growing in many parts of Asia, likewise in Latin and Central America. It is only in America and North America and Western Europe that we see Christianity declining. In fact, I've seen statistics that say that in every century since the time of Christ, Christianity has grown. The number of Christians has grown, both in terms of total numbers and in terms of a percentage of the world's population. So, yes, this is a disturbing trend here in this country right now, but it isn't reflected worldwide, and I'm thinking it's probably going to be temporary.
Now, what would be your comment to somebody who would say, okay, you quoted earlier the Declaration of Independence. We all know that Thomas Jefferson was the chief author, or at least of the first draft of the Declaration of Independence. A lot of the words are still his words. And he talks about God and the Creator and so forth, and yet not all of Jefferson's views were orthodox. And I'd like to hear your response to that. And before you do, I just want to say this. Jefferson wrote those words in 1776. In 1777, and this is a little-known fact, he and other laymen founded an evangelical church. Thomas Jefferson founded an evangelical church, and they called the Reverend Charles Clay, who was an evangelical minister ordained in the Anglican tradition. Jefferson wrote up the bylaws for that church, the Calvinistical Reformed Church of Charlottesville. Later, did Jefferson have some weird ideas, you know, that were unorthodox as far as Christianity? Absolutely. But in the meantime, a year after he wrote the Declaration of Independence, he was not only worshiping the Christian God, he was facilitating it so others could worship the Christian God. And by the way, Jefferson gave more money to that church than did any of the other laymen.
What you're saying there is absolutely correct. And there's an excellent book put out by Providence Foundation titled Doubting Thomas that goes into a lot of that in much greater detail. And might add to that that particular evangelical pastor, Jefferson, even at a later time when he seems to have departed from some Christian doctrine, but even at a later time, he continued to support Reverend Clay. And late in life, he and Reverend Clay had correspondence in which Jefferson wrote to him and said, "You and I have talked more about religion than I have with any other living person." And yet, Reverend Clay never expressed any doubts as to Jefferson's Christianity. Now, the real important thing as to our founding and was what Jefferson believed when he wrote the Declaration of Independence in 1776, not what he may have believed in the 1800s. But from what I can tell, we have no evidence at all of any doubts that Jefferson had about Christianity until 1787, at which time he is serving as an ambassador in France. And he's asked to be the godfather to a child by somebody that'd be conferred by the Church of England. And he said that he could not do so because he said, "I do not understand the doctrine of the Trinity, and therefore I cannot affirm it." And notice he doesn't say that he denies the Trinity. He says, "I don't understand it." Well, at a later time, it certainly appears that he rejects the concept of the Trinity, and possibly with it the divinity of Jesus Christ, and that would be in the 1800s. Now, he was at this time probably a Unitarian, although he never really identified as a Unitarian for what I can see, but he never was a deist. He never denied that God is actively involved in human affairs. In fact, when he says, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that he will not stay his judgment forever," or when he says in his second inaugural address, which would have been about 1804 or 5, when he says there that "I shall need the favor of that being in whose hands we are, who led our forefathers as Israel of old." Clearly, he believed in a God who was actively involved in human history. So while he may have been a Unitarian at this time, he was never a deist in the sense of denying that there is a God who's actively involved in human affairs. Also, as Providence Foundation demonstrates, it appears that as we move into the 1820s, Jefferson rejoins the church and starts to move back toward orthodoxy again. How far toward orthodoxy, we don't really know, but he does seem to have moved in that direction.
Very good. And by the way, let me just say something real fast. I was the co-author of that book you're mentioning, Doubting Thomas, which I co-wrote with Mark Belisles. He's the one who did the mega share of the research, but it's exactly right what you said, that the different phases of Jefferson's faith or the lack thereof. But now let's talk about the Constitution. I know you wrote about the Constitution explicitly. Jefferson wasn't there when they wrote that, but there's two law professors, and you teach law and you certainly wouldn't agree with this book, but there's a book called The Godless Constitution, very thin, no footnotes, no, not one, and it basically maintains that the Founding Fathers explicitly, purposefully left God out of the Constitution, and so my comment is, or my question rather, is what say you?
Well, it's one thing they say at the beginning of that book that they have not used footnotes because they believe everything they're saying is common knowledge. Well, that's a good way of saying I don't want to bother proving what I can't prove. And that's no, I think what they're saying is absolutely incorrect in that book. And first of all, when you look to the Constitution, there is mention of God in a couple of senses. First of all, at the beginning, one of the purposes of government in the preamble, it says, is to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity. Blessing is something that is conferred by a higher source. And then at the close of the Constitution, where we see the ratification clause, there it says, this done by unanimous consent of the states present in this year of our Lord, 1787. Now, year of our Lord is not just a reference to God, it's to the birth of Jesus Christ. And so, in so saying, they bought into the Christian order because even England had adopted the Gregorian calendar only about 25 years before this. But part of the reason that they aren't more explicit about this in the Constitution is that the Constitution is more of a mechanical document, and really it has to be read in light of the Declaration. In a sense, the Declaration is a more fundamental law than the Constitution. You could say the Declaration establishes the nation. The Constitution establishes the government. And when Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address says, 47 years ago, our forefathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, he is referring not to 1787, 87 years earlier, he's referring to 1776. And so you might say the Declaration sets forth the ideals and principles upon which the nation is founded. The Constitution establishes a practical mechanism by which those ideals can be realized in an imperfect society of people like you and me. So that's one of the reasons that it isn't more explicit in the Declaration or in the Constitution, is that they are really relying on the Declaration as the true preamble to the Constitution.
Okay, so we have about a minute and a half left. So summing up our top story, if we take God out of the equation, again, is America one nation under God? If we take the Lord out of the equation, then we really have no legitimate source for our rights. It's just basically, as Bill Federer likes to say, what the government giveth, the government can taketh away. You know, and even John F. Kennedy in his inaugural address said that we need to remember what the forebears said, that the rights of man come not from the generous hand of the state, but rather from the hand of God.
Absolutely. Justice Douglas recognized this in several of his Supreme Court.
And he was a liberal.
He was a liberal, and yet he was the son of a Presbyterian pastor. But he said, we are a religious people whose institutions presuppose a divine being. And that this divine being, as he says further, is the source of our rights. And these are rights that are higher than government and that government must respect.
Wow, that's great. I know exactly what you're talking about. I just, in writing a column, I quoted that very quote, the first part of it at least, the Zorak v. Clausen, 1952. I just looked it up. That's why it's all fresh to me. So, John, do you have a website or
the
anything?
The second part of that quote, though, is from another. The second part of the quote is from another decision. I think that was McCollum versus Board of Education.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's why it wasn't, you know, immediately familiar with me. Moral Foundation or Moral Law Foundation, what is the website that you're associated
Foundation
with?
Foundation for Moral Law, the website is morallaw.org. Google anything close to that and you'll find us.
All right, John Ijmo, always a pleasure. Thank you, sir. All the best.
Thank you, Jerry.